Welcome to Aspects of Riding with your host, James Kelly. For the next 60 minutes, we'll explore every aspect of riding, including how to create, format, and even sell your work. Now, let's get right. Here's your host, James Kelly.
Hello and welcome to Aspects of Riding. I'm your host, James Kelly, and my co-host for today's show is Tanya Todd. Our guest is Elliot Parker, and today we're going to be talking about discovering your talent for riding. First, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Tanya Todd. So, Tanya, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I am an author and an actress. I'm the education chair for Henderson Writers Group, and I run an author meet and greet called Dime Grinds.
Okay. Our guest is Elliot Parker, and he has quite a bit here to talk about. I'll just go ahead and read this. Elliot is the author of four novels, including his most recent book, A Knife's Edge, which was an honorable mention in thriller writing at the London Book Festival, and is the sequel to the award-winning novel Fragile Brilliance. His novel Code for Murder was named a 2018 finalist for genre fiction by American Book Fest. Fragile Brilliance was a finalist for the Southern Book Prize in thriller writing. He recently received the Thriller Writing Award by the National Association of Book Editors for his novels. In addition, Elliot is the host of the podcast Now Appalachia, which profiles authors and publishers living and writing in the Appalachian region and can be heard on Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, as well as Blog Talk Radio. A graduate of Bluegrass Writer Studio at Eastern Kentucky University with an MFA in creative writing and a doctorate in English from Murray State University. Elliot teaches English at the University of Mississippi and lives in Oxford, Mississippi and Chesapeake Bay, Ohio. You live between two of them?
Yeah, got homes both places.
Okay, so 6 months here and 6 months there?
Pretty much, yeah.
So where are you now?
I'm in Oxford, Mississippi right now.
Okay.
Because the school semester is still underway.
Okay. Oh. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Charleston, West Virginia, and spent most of my life in West Virginia up until the last year and a half or so when I took the job, as James was talking about, at the University of Mississippi. So born and bred West Virginian, born and bred Appalachian. But yeah, I grew up in Charleston, lived there, went to school there, lived in Huntington, West Virginia, where I taught at Marsh University and at Mount West Community and Technical College for 14 years, and then took the job at the University of Mississippi at Ole Miss about a year and a half ago.
All right. So tell us about your latest novel.
So my latest novel, A Knife's Edge, follows the character, I guess, a police sergeant named Ronan McCullough. And he is a carryover character from Fragile Brilliance, which was the first book in the series. And basically what A Knife's Edge is about is Ronan is investigating the murder of a mutual acquaintance, someone that he knows sort of not real well, but knows of her. She's found murdered, and he has to investigate what happened to her and why was she killed in such a brutal way. And what he ends up finding out as he kind of peels back the layers of the investigation and he starts digging deep into her life, he realizes that she had a lot of personal and professional conflicts in her personal and professional life, which kind of intersected. And those conflicts brought a lot of people into her life. And some of those people were not the best people to have kind of brought into her life. And so it's kind of this big mystery, this sort of big puzzle he's trying to put together. He's trying to find out who she was. The woman's name or the girl's name that he kind of knows is Sarah Gilmore. So he's trying to put the pieces of Sarah Gilmore's past and present together. And as he kind of keeps looking into her life and finding out more about her, he realizes that she wasn't quite the person that he thought she was or had heard that she was from their mutual acquaintance friends. And so that's really the investigation. But there's a lot more there as well. It's more than just him investigating what happened to her. As he starts digging into more of her life, he realizes that she was involved in some things professionally and personally that were pretty dangerous and pretty nefarious.
Mm. Well, I'm going to give you a chance later on, but why don't you go ahead and tell us now where the book is available?
Sure. You can get A Knife's Edge anywhere you like to get books, and I would certainly encourage folks to visit your local independent bookstore if you have one in your community or your town.
Thank you for that.
yes, because I can tell you as a writer, when I was just starting out, and Tanya, you probably know this too, your independent bookstores, when you're first starting out as a writer, they're your biggest champions and your biggest advocates. And they're the ones that'll have you for the book signings, and they're the ones that'll put your book out on display first and talk to readers and people that come into the bookstore the most. And so if you can get it from an independent bookstore, please do so. If you can get it from any independent bookstore or any other place you like to buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, just about anywhere you like to get books, you can get a copy of the book.
Did you start off as self-published, or have you always been traditionally published?
I've always been traditionally published. I had looked and experimented a little bit with self-publishing, and I'm certainly a huge fan of self-publishing. I think, you know, we're very fortunate as writers today, James, because there's so many ways we can get our work out to an audience. But at the same time, I'm not very organized and very on top of things in terms of promoting and marketing and all the things that you have to do as a self-published author. And so I found out pretty quickly that was not the best use of my skill sets. I mean, I feel like that I like to write and I like to spend that time writing. You know, I can certainly do the marketing and certainly do the promotion. But, you know, when you take on that path of self-publishing your work, you are your everything. You are your publisher. You are your cover designer. You are your marketer. You are your PR person. You are everything.
Bookkeeper,
accountant, everything.
Yeah.
And some people, you know, like that aspect of it really well. And you certainly there's services and people you can hire to help you do things like the book cover and help you with editing and that sort of thing. But ultimately, the lion's share of the work falls on you as the author. And I just found that wasn't really one of my best strong suits. I didn't want to take on all that responsibility, especially the accounting. I mean, if I can balance my checkbook, I'm having a good math day. So I don't want to be responsible for invoicing and keeping track of what went what to what bookstore and what distributor and all of that. So no, I've been very fortunate that that my books have been traditionally published. And I'm thankful for that because all the publishers I've worked with have just been wonderful and fantastic and have really helped me both as a writer on the technical level, but also helped me build my platform and build some following and interest in my books as well. So I've been very fortunate there.
Yeah, I think the problem is that there are so many authors out there today that it's kind of difficult to find a publisher.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what was your path to publication? How did you find them and what did you do to secure a publisher?
I did a couple of things. I would encourage folks to go to a writing conference. I try to go to one big national writing conference every year. I've been to Thriller Fest in New York before. I've been to the Killer Nashville Conference in Tennessee. I've been to Left Coast Crime before, and I go to these because I write in that genre, mystery and thriller. But I would encourage folks to go to one big book festival every year, and if you have that opportunity, sign up for chances to talk to publishers and to talk to agents. That's where I got most of my publishers, was just them being at these conferences, and I would sign up for a slot, you know, a 10 or 15 minute slot. You go and you pitch your work or your idea or what you're working on to that publisher or that agent. And from there, it just kind of picks up and goes from there. What I found, too, in that process is even if that person you are pitching to or that publisher or agent you're pitching to is not interested in your work, I'm amazed at how many of them say, you know, I have a friend that works at XYZ publishing house, or I have a friend who is with this literary agency. This would be something right up his or her alley, so to speak. So, you know, I'm not interested or I can't take it, but contact so-and-so, and you can tell them that I told you to contact.
And Tanya.
And so I've had a lot of success that way. But, you know, getting in front of these folks and letting them be able to put a name and a face together is one of the best ways you as an author can get picked up by a traditional publisher.
I think, Tanya, don't you also set up a conference every year, or you're part of the Henderson Writers
Group?
Yeah,
Henderson Writers Group does Las Vegas Writers Conference every year, and we bring in publishers and literary agents, and pitch sessions are included in the cost of the conference.
That's great. And I would encourage folks to take that opportunity to do that. And I know, you know, you can certainly send query letters and you can certainly, you know, go through, you know, publishers that don't require agents, you know, have all that information on their website. And that's certainly another way you can get noticed as an author, but you can actually get in front of that person who's going to be responsible for publishing your work, either the agent or the publisher. Let them see you and talk to you and kind of get to know you as a person. But that's going to enhance your chances that you know, your book's going to get picked up.
So. Right. You can't beat that one-on-one feedback that you could get from talking to them. Even if they don't take it, they can help you get to the next level.
That's exactly right. And a lot of this too, Tanya, and James and I talked about this before we started talking today and taping the show today, a lot of this is networking and relationships.
Yeah.
You know, that publisher or that agent may not be interested in your work or you or whatever, but you know, you've got that person that you can put in your contacts list, and you never know when 6 months, a year and a half, 2 years from now, you need to go back to that person for something. A lot of this is networking and relationship building, and you certainly get that when you have an opportunity to sit down and talk to those folks face-to-face.
So on your podcast, are you mainly interviewing published authors or self-published or a little of both?
Done a little bit of both. More traditionally published authors here in the last year or so. This is my second year. I'm coming up on my third year in August of 2020 of doing Now Appalachia. And I was real pleased that, you know, last year in 2019, when Pam Stack, who kind of owns and operates Authors on the Air Global Radio Network and hires the hosts and structures the podcast, was doing her tabulations, that Now Appalachia was the third most listened to podcast on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And I was just floored by that when she told me that.
That's great.
And so I'm real pleased. And I started doing this, you know, she asked me to do it a couple years ago, and I thought, well, I'll do this for 6 months. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But it was a good experience and something I could try. But it's just gone so well. And she's been a huge supporter of the program. But what I'm finding now, back to your original question, is that I'm now getting, you know, tons and tons, literally, of books sent to me, media kits sent to me by publishers and by authors and by agents wanting to come on the show. So when I first started, I was kind of having to reach out to folks that I knew or that I thought might want to be on the program. Now I've got folks sort of coming to the program and wanting to be on and asking if they can come on. So it's shifted a little bit, but so we started off doing a few self-published authors just to kind of get things going and get the program underway. And we still do some self-published authors, but the influx of requests that we're getting now for interviews is coming from mostly traditionally published authors.
Mm-hmm. We both have a show that deals with writing. The difference is that mine is geared more towards the self-published author. It, you know, we go out there and we try to take the novice writer and convince them that you can do this. If you really have the desire, you can do this. I wanted to ask you, you've been writing now for a while. When did you start writing and why?
I started writing, the earliest memory I can have writing is when I was in eighth grade. And I had an English teacher named Mr. Cyrus who encouraged me and really got me interested in writing. And we would have times throughout the school year where we would just go in to class. Usually it was on Fridays or it was on, you know, days before long, you know, Christmas break or Thanksgiving break. And we would just have, like, creative writing days. And he would give us prompts. Some of them were silly. Some of them were fun.
It sounds wonderful.
Yes, it was wonderful. Some of them were serious. Sometimes he would give us the beginning of a story and we'd have to finish it. And I love those. Those are some of my favorite days in his class. But he constantly encouraged me. He constantly asked me how my writing was coming along. He would give me little slips of paper that would have quotes about writing on them, you know, from time to time when I would see him. So he really encouraged me. But it wasn't until I became a student at Marshall University when I was an undergrad. And a friend of mine, Zach, had created a creative writing club on campus. And I was a journalism major as an undergrad. And a lot of journalism majors had to take so many English classes as part of their graduation requirements. So we became big pals with a lot of English majors, and Zach was an English major. So long story short, he convinced me to join this creative writing club. And the last year that I was a member of the club, we all agreed to work on a piece and sort of workshop that piece together over the course of the year and send it out for publication or publication request. This was before Submittable and all those other. This is when you actually had to mail them out. Self-addressed stamped envelopes to get feedback and responses. And there was a little literary journal at Mary Washington College, Mary Washington University in Virginia, that published the ghost story I had been working on. And that was the first time that I really had someone publish something that I had written creatively. And that was the first time that I realized, well, maybe this is something worth pursuing. And then that was in 1999, 2000. So I've been writing really consistently, ever since.
Mm. Tanya, I think you know the two guys, Fox. Is it TJ or CJ Fox that write together?
I remember meeting.
And they bring a group of people together, and they decide on a storyline. And there may be even 5, 6, 7 people working on the same book, and then they put it out under one name. That's kind of an interesting take, kind of a little bit what you were talking about.
Seems like a tough venture.
it was a great experience, and I still keep in contact with some of those guys that were in and gals that were in that creative writing group. And some of them are still writing, and some of them quit writing after college and all of that. But yeah, we still do keep in touch.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your book again, the latest one that just came out. You said that you took a character from a previous book. What inspired you to write this character story?
Well, I think that I got to the end of Fragile Brilliance, which is the first book in the Ronan McCullough series, and I just wasn't quite finished with that character. I felt like that there was a lot more story to be told with him. And when I had some people beta reading the book before it came out, the Fragile Brilliance came out in 2016. And when I had some people beta reading the manuscript, one of the constant comments I got from beta readers was, you know, this could easily be a series, or are you going to make this a series? Or are you going to keep working with Ronan as a character? And so that kind of got me thinking about, you know, maybe would I want to carry him forward in another book? And so I leave Fragile Brilliance, the end of Fragile Brilliance, kind of open-ended, where you wonder if Ronan will be back. And he does come back in A Knife's Edge. And it was a lot of fun writing another book with him, because I already kind of knew him a little bit, and I knew some of the other characters that were involved in his story, so I was able to bring them back. The big challenge, though, was having them grow as the second book unfolded. Because, you know, you certainly want your characters, if you're doing a series, and I'm learning this going forward, if you're creating a series with a certain set of characters, you want those characters to have a certain core set of values and traits and personality characteristics and all of that. But you also don't want them to be the same at the end of the second book as they were at the beginning of the first book.
Right.
So the challenge is putting them in circumstances and situations where they can grow and develop as characters. And so that was the big challenge. But, you know, Ronan has a lot of challenges, you know, not counting what goes on in the murder investigations that he's investigating. You know, he's not from West Virginia. He's from Boston, Massachusetts. He's gay. He's in a relationship with his boyfriend, Ty Andino, who is an emergency room nurse at Charleston Mercy Hospital, which is interesting because Charleston Mercy Hospital, which is based on an actual hospital in Charleston called the CAMC, Charleston General, is the only Trauma 1 hospital in the state. So anytime that there is someone taken to the hospital for gunshots or injured in an explosion, they go there. And so the police are in and out of the emergency room all the time. And so that means that Ronan's and Ty's personal and professional lives are constantly intersecting, because he's going in there when criminals are doing things and getting themselves injured and shot, stabbed, mm-hmm. and having
all the fun stuff.
So it brings their personal and professional lives together. And of course, you know, Ronan has to protect his sexuality from the police department, because he would be sort of ostracized if they found out. So having a gay cop kind of working and operating in the heart of Appalachia is something that, you know, he has to deal with and struggles with. So he's got a lot of personal and professional turmoil going on, swirling around him, in lieu of and sort of in addition to the actual murder investigations that he's looking at in both of those books, both Fragile Brilliance and A Knife's Edge.
Sounds like a recipe for a very good story.
It's been a lot of fun. He's a great character. I love spending time with him and Ty both.
So you probably have plans for this character in another book.
Yes, I'm working on the third book right now in the series. And someone asked me the other day or sent me an email through my website wanting to know how many. They'd read A Knife's Edge first and then went back and read Fragile Brilliance and then read A Knife's Edge again to kind of see how the two books connected. And she asked me, you know, when do I envision this series stopping? You know, I don't know if this will be like James Patterson's Alex Cross series, which will go on for, you know, 10 or 14 or 15 books or something like that. But in my mind, I've got at least three more books planned in sort of this story arc for him. And so I'm working on the third book right now, which takes place almost immediately after the conclusion of what happens at the end of A Knife's Edge. When Fragile Brilliance concludes, there's about 6 months between the end of Fragile Brilliance and the start of A Knife's Edge. But the third book is going to pick up immediately after, like the next day after what happens at the end of A Knife's Edge. And so in my mind, I've got a five-book series or five-book storyline for Ronan and Ty and these characters. But depending on what happens when we get to book five, if I feel like it's still going strong, we might carry them forward. But I've got in my mind kind of how the fifth book's going to end and how it's going to wrap up Ronan and Ty's storyline, and we're going to find out if they get to live happily ever after, or if,
okay.
if the strain of, you know, trying to be in a relationship and find love against all these circumstances and amongst this terrible violence will rip them apart. So, you know, we'll find out by the time we get to book five.
All right. Well, we're going to be discussing today one's talent for writing, and I know you talked a little bit about your writing, you know, when you got involved, but when did you discover you actually had the ability to write that first book? Like, what in your mind clicked and said, I can do this?
Yeah, that's a great question, James. I think a lot of it started with having success writing short stories. I started working on short stories, and when I went to the Bluegrass Writers Studio at Eastern Kentucky University to get my MFA, they start you out writing short stories. And one of the things I've learned about writing short stories is that when you write short stories, you've got to have clear and concise descriptions, and you've got to have really good character development, because you're telling a story in 7,500 words or less. You've got to have everything that kind of sets the tone and the atmosphere and gives the reader a sense of what's going on in that story. So after I had written several short stories, I had some more published. I mentioned the one that was published by Mary Washington College when I was at Marshall. I had a few more short stories published while I was in my MFA program at EKU. And that's when I started thinking about tackling a novel. And I had one of my professors, Derek Nikitas at EKU, said this to me about this, and I told him I was thinking about writing a novel, and he said, well, look at it this way. He said, when you're writing a novel is basically a series of short stories. And I didn't get what he was saying at first, but he said, basically, when you're writing a novel, you know, your character wants something, and it should be pretty evident from the very first page or the very first couple of pages what it is that they want. And each chapter of a novel is that character trying to determine if they're going to get what it is that they want, or what it is they think they want. And at the end of that chapter, you have to ask yourself as the writer, are they getting closer to accomplishing that, or are they getting pushed farther away from it? And I, you know, that sat with me for a long time. I thought about it for a long time. And then when I sat down to write my first novel, which was called The Breakdown at Clear River, which was set in West Virginia on a fictional college campus, that's basically kind of the mindset that I used, is that I'm writing one big, long short story. And my main character in that book was named Cullen Brewer. And ultimately, Cullen has certain things that he wants. And is he getting closer to that by the end of each chapter? And sometimes he gets a little closer, and sometimes he gets pushed farther back. And so that's really stuck with me when I thought about writing a novel. And when that book got published by Mid-Atlantic Highlands Publishing in 2012, that was when I really felt like, and it got a lot of good reviews. It sold very well. It was well received both, you know, in West Virginia and throughout Appalachia and beyond. That's when I realized, you know, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could kind of make that shift from being a short story writer to a novelist. But had I not been able, I don't think, to kind of get a handle on the short story genre, I don't think I would have been nearly as successful as a novelist. And I did want to mention, I have a short story collection coming out in May of 2020 called Snapshots.
Okay.
So some of my short stories that I've had published over the last few years are going to be in that collection, and there's going to be five or six all new pieces as well. So even though I'm still writing novels and I love writing novels now, I still kind of dabble in writing short stories. And I feel like that's where I cut my teeth, so to speak, as a writer, and that's helped me so much in writing novels. And what Derek told me about looking at how you structure a novel as one big short story with a series of ups and downs really helped me kind of understand how that process works.
Well, I like the title.
Yeah, absolutely. The perspective coming from a teacher's standpoint of being able to write is different from someone like myself, I don't have the college degree. I have some college, but not the college degree. English was not my best subject. So what advice would you give someone who may not have the education that you have as far as, or can you even visualize them becoming an author?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite quotes about writing, I have two great, really great quotes about writing. One is by Ray Bradbury, who says, when we write, we jump off the cliff and find our wings on the way down. And that was his response to kind of the same question James just asked, you know, can anybody be a writer? And then one of my favorite historians, David McCullough, says this about writing. He says, you know, people ask me all the time, you know, he wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning books, John Adams and Truman, which are two of the best books on any subject I've ever read. I would encourage folks to read those, especially if you want to be a writer, for the way he tells stories, the way he takes a nonfiction person's life and makes it read like fiction. But he says, people ask me all the time, you know, David, how long did it take you to write that book? But he said, nobody ever asks me, David, how long did you think about that book before you started writing? And so, you know, those are the two quotes I would say keep in mind if you want to write and you don't have the background, is that, you know, you're going to find your wings on the way down. You're going to find your voice. You're going to find your process. You're going to find if you're a morning writer, an afternoon writer. Can you write on a laptop? Do you write on a legal pad? Do you write on a desktop computer? Can you write in a coffee shop? You have to have complete silence.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You're going to find all of that out as well. But also, you know, so much of it is thinking. It's thinking about what kind of story is it that you want to tell, and how can you tell it, and can you tell it to the best of your ability? And there's so many other ways that you can sort of beef up your skills or put some things in your toolkit if you don't have that background as a writer. And we talked about one of them a moment ago, which is going to writers' conferences. Those are wonderful opportunities to go to workshops and hear from published writers about strategies and tips. If you're in a community that's fortunate enough to have a writing group, I would highly advise you to join that. If there's not a writing group in your community, start one.
Right.
Go to your local public library, start there. Have those folks email everybody that's on the public library listserv. Go to community centers, go to colleges and universities and advertise. Go to the high schools and put out information. Start one if there's not one in your community. That's a great way to meet other writers and to kind of pick up tricks and techniques that other writers are using when they write. But I would say, in addition to all that, guys, that there's no substitute for the work. You know, a lot of people talk about, and I know, Tanya, you probably experienced this too, a lot of people talk about writing and wanting to be a writer, but it doesn't happen unless, you know, unless you're in the seat doing the work.
Right.
Right.
And you can't be afraid to do that. You can't be afraid of it and think to yourself and tell yourself, well, I don't have a degree in this, or I didn't take any classes in creative writing or whatever. There's no substitute for sitting down and doing the work. And
a degree doesn't mean that your first draft isn't going to suck, you know?
Absolutely. That's true.
I tell people all the time when I'm speaking, giving presentations and workshops, I say, you know, anytime I sit down, in a lot of ways, when I sit down to write a novel, even a short story, I feel like I'm learning, I'm doing this all again for the first time in some ways. But I know in the back of my mind that whatever I put on the computer screen, I kind of type as I go as a writer, a third of it's not going to make it to the final draft.
Right.
And that's okay. You know, what I'm doing in that first draft is just trying to tell the story. Tell the story in a way that I think is organized, structured, and interesting. And then I can go back and decide, well, I'm going to keep this character or take that chapter out or move this over here or anything like that. And I think a lot of beginning writers feel like that first draft's got to be, you know, the rock that they're going to build the rest of the book on. And oftentimes the first draft is just getting your story on paper, getting it on the computer screen, and then going back and the real writing, I think, comes in revision. But if you put too much pressure on yourself to get that first draft perfect, you're gonna drive yourself crazy. So I think all of those things can, you know, compensate for the fact that maybe you don't have an English degree or haven't taken any creative writing courses. It's just a lot of trial and error. It's finding your process, finding your voice, finding how you work, and then looking, you know, in your sphere of life and in your community for other resources and other places where you can sort of beef up your skills and put tools in your toolkit. Sometimes that includes going to conferences and going out of state and going to national conferences and attending workshops. So it's kind of a mixed bag of a lot of things that you can do, but don't let the lack of a degree or lack of training in creative writing keep you from being a writer. If you've got a great story to tell, it should be told and it will come together.
Well, yeah, and I think it's a misnomer to think that if you have a degree that you can automatically write as well. And I think that that is an ability that you're either born with or you acquire as you go along in life. And being a storyteller is not the same thing as having a degree. So, you know, if you just have that ability to tell a story, and Tanya, you know the same person I'm talking about, and I'm talking about Tony Pacini in particular.
Oh, okay.
Tony did not have a high school degree, not even, you know, a high school degree. And she went on to write a novel, and I think she surprised everyone. She also heads a writer's group here in the Las Vegas area called Sin City Writers Group. And it's fairly large. I think they have.
It started out as one night a week, and it expanded so much that they had to go 2 to 3 nights.
Right. And in fact, they meet here at my facility one night a week, and they're getting ready to divide that into 2 groups. So it doesn't matter what your background is. It's the desire to do it and the ability to create, I think, is the drive there is what's necessary. That's why we have editors, you know. If you're uncertain how to form a syntax, the correct syntax, or not certain on how to punctuate, that you hire an editor to help you with that.
And there are books that can teach you that too.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, finding a good editor and finding an editor that you trust and can work with is pivotally important. But you're absolutely right. If you sit down when you're writing a draft of something, a short story or a chapter of a novel, you obsess over and worry over getting every comma in the right place in the first draft, you're never going to make any progress. You know, you need to think about, am I telling my story?
Right.
Am I moving the story forward? And am I keeping the reader engaged and keeping them wanting to turn to the next page or go to the next chapter or whatever it is, the next scene, if you're writing a screenplay or something like that? You know, those are the big goals you want to keep in mind when you're writing that first draft, not do I have all the punctuation in the right place, because you can always come back to that later.
And likely you don't, even if you do have a degree, you don't have the punctuation in the right place.
Absolutely.
My creative side does not always work in sync with my organizational side. You know, it's just when you're creating, I don't know how to spell when I'm creating, but I'm an editor. I do have that ability, but not while I'm creating.
And I've had people in the past when I've done seminars ask the question, well, how do I even start? And I always tell them, write the first sentence. If you can just write the first sentence, you have something to go from. Doesn't matter whether it's in the beginning, the middle, or the end. You know, just write something and then build from there. A lot of people do an outline. I don't do an outline. Tanya, do you? Elliot?
I don't do an outline. I'm not a pantser, though.
Yeah. Go ahead,
yeah,
Elliot.
Yeah, same here. You know, there's kind of two theories on the outlining. You know, James Patterson, we mentioned him a moment ago. He does these really detailed outlines. If you've ever listened to him talk about how he plots out a book, you know, he writes these 16, 18, 22 page outlines that is so detailed. He knows the color of the shirt that the police officer in chapter 14 is going to wear even before he even gets to chapter 14. And I don't do anything, you know, that organized. You know, I have sort of a poster board in my office when I work at home, and I use post-it notes. I have different color post-it notes for different things. I have pink post-it notes for character, green post-it notes for setting, yellow post-it notes for plot points. And I'm sort of moving this around. It's sort of like a Price is Right game. I'm moving the squares around all the time to try to get a good combination. But that helps me stay organized, and that helps me see that I'm making progress.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly don't do, you know, the detailed 16 to 18 page outline. Because for me as a writer, I feel like I get too wedded to that, and I get too attached to that, and then sometimes I don't let characters and plot points kind of take their own direction as I'm writing, and they don't take me in surprising places if I'm so glued to that outline. But we're talking about first lines too. You know, Stephen King's got a great book that I would highly recommend everybody get. It's called On Writing.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you've never read Stephen King or you don't like horror writing, which I'm not a big horror genre fan, but he's got so much practical advice about not only writing creatively, but just writing in general. And he has a chapter in that book about writing the first line and how important first lines are. And he talks about how some of his books over the years drove him crazy because he obsessed over that first line. How was he going to start that first line?
Right, and that's exactly what I've discovered.
And that's exactly what you were saying, James. You know, if you can get the first line, if you can get that first sentence on the page, and this is ultimately kind of what King gets to at the end of that chapter, if you can get that first sentence down, then you're on your way. You know, now you've got your first sentence. Now it's time to add another. Now let's add a paragraph after that. Now let's add some dialogue after that. The next thing you know, you've got a chapter already finished where you didn't think you could get there. So, you know, the power of first lines is really important, both, you know, from a storytelling perspective, but also psychologically. Right? You know, to be able to say, you know, I've got the first line, now let's build from there.
How do you start? Start.
You know, I actually had someone in 1996 who came to a seminar I was doing, and where this came from. She asked me, what do I need to do? And I said, write the first line. Her name is Tina Gross. And she actually did write a book after she wrote that first sentence.
Nice.
When she wrote that first sentence, she realized, I can do this.
And sometimes it's just a matter of, if you're typing on the computer, just seeing that first line of text on the screen. You know, it's just an amazing confidence boost, and it's just amazing psychological success when you're writing anything, even if you've written a lot or been published a lot. You know, just seeing that first sentence is like, all right, I'm underway. It's sort of like at a horse race when they kick the gates back and blow the, you know, sound the bell. Well, we're underway.
That's right.
So when the first line is there, you got to go. You know, you're on your way. So it's a tremendous benefit to get that first line.
It sounds like your characters, they're character driven. Your books are character driven, because there's a famous author out there. I'm not going to mention his name, but I see him every once in a while on CBS in the morning, anytime he has something new coming out. And he talked about how no one should ever allow the characters to steer the book. You're in charge of that book. And I'm thinking, I've never written that way. I've always allowed my characters to drive me forward. I've actually gone back and created characters based on another character's interaction with someone else. From the beginning, I've had to go back and add someone. What's your take on that?
I'm kind of in your camp, James, on that, because I feel like, and I do this as a reader, and I feel like a lot of readers are this way, we latch on to characters. We latch on to a certain character in a story or a certain set of characters, and we want to see what's going to happen to those characters.
Right.
Yes, we might latch on to the setting. We might latch on to the time of year, if it's wintertime, summertime, whatever. But what sustains us through the narrative is a character or a set of characters. You know, I've had some readers tell me, you know, within my books that maybe they didn't like Ronan, or they didn't like Stacey Tavitt, who's a female homicide detective in my book, Code for Murder. They didn't really connect with her, but they connected with the villain that she was pursuing, or the suspected villain that she was pursuing, or he was pursuing, if it's Ronan or someone else. And that's perfectly fine, too. You can certainly embrace the bad guy. I do a great workshop called Writing Bad Guys That Readers Love to Hate. And we talk about this whole process of developing a bad guy that a reader doesn't always approve of, but can't sort of stay away from at the same time. So, you know, I feel like that's what readers latch on to in stories is character. And if you've got a protagonist or an antagonist or both, or some smaller role-playing characters, some foil characters that connect to the main character in some way, you know, that's who the reader is going to connect with as they're reading. And that's what they're going to remember when they put your book down. When they get to the last page and close the back cover, they're going to think about that character that they've spent 300 pages following, or 15 or 16 pages if it's a short story following. You know, they're going to think about, you know, where that journey for that character started, where it ended, and what they felt and how they felt about that journey. And you have to have a plot. You certainly do. You have to have, you know, all of the rising action, the climax, the falling mm-hmm. action, the typical story arc structure. I mean, that's how stories are told, particularly in novels. But I just feel like what readers latch on to is character.
And you make it. You have to make it plausible too. I mean, my first novel actually, there was a character who was going to propose to his fiance. Well, she was his fiance. He was going to propose to her on a trip, and he had his buddy go with him. And I'm thinking, it doesn't make sense that this guy would be tagging along if he's going to propose to this woman. So I thought, what can I do? So I actually created a wife for him. So I had to go back to the beginning of the story and add her in to the story. She actually became a main character as well. If you allow your imagination to say, is this plausible? Would this make sense? I think you can actually enhance the story with other characters.
I totally agree. And what your readers remember about what you were just describing is not the proposal itself. It's that female character that you went back and put at the beginning of the story. That's who they're going to latch on to.
Yeah.
You know, they want to see the proposal and see it unfold, but they're going to want to spend some time with that character and get to know her and get to know and assume how she may react to the proposal and what might she say when she's asked.
And her interaction with his new fiance once
had
proposed.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yes. So that's what readers are going to latch on to those characters and the dynamics that you put them in and the situation that you put them in, not necessarily the situation itself. If that makes any sense. So I don't know who that famous writer is that you're talking about.
I won't mention his name.
I think stories driven by character are so much more interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
Than the other way around.
I also have a tendency to want to believe my characters exist. I get to know them so well that oftentimes when I'm telling the story, especially with my first novel, I would tell the story and people would say, how did you know these people? Where did you meet them? And I had a gentleman on yesterday.
The Muse.
Yeah, R.J. Waters. And he's just written a new book that just came out. And he had the same experience, that when he would go to a conference or something and he was telling someone about his story, so how did you know them? Was that when you were a detective? And he's thinking, what are they talking about? This is a fictional story, you know? To me, these characters come to life, so it's almost impossible for me not to let them guide the story. Because in my mind, they have come to life and they're a part of reality, even though we know they're fiction and it's in a book. they have to live for me. They can't just be words on paper.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I feel that way when I'm writing a Ronan McCullough novel, when I'm writing a Stacey Tavitt novel. In fact, I'm working on the sequel to Code for Murder right now. And it's due to the publisher in August. So I've got August of 2020. So I've got to get working here to get this done for hopefully a release date in 2021 or 2022. But yeah, it's that same thing. These characters become a part of you. You feel like you're living with them. I mean, I have moments when I'm writing, working on the sequel to Code for Murder that I feel like Stacey's standing over my shoulder, watching me and listening to me. Or I look up and she's walking down the hallway when I'm writing a scene where she's walking down the hallway. You know, I feel like that she's there. But I need to feel that. I'm with you, James. I need to feel that as a writer, because that's if I'm feeling that way, and I'm the author of the story and I'm creating this character in these circumstances that he or she's going to be in, then the reader, chances are, is going to feel that very same way about that character. That character is going to come to life for them, sort of leap off the page and become a part of their conscious and subconscious. And that's really what you want, I think, as a writer. And going back, I have some friends that write nonfiction. They talk about this all the time. They say, I feel like I'm writing a book about, John Smith or whomever. And they say, I feel like I've lived with John Smith for 2 years because I've been writing about his life and where he grew up and his family. And I feel like he's been sitting in my living room the entire time for the last 2 years. But then that I think shows itself in the book, and it shows itself in the story. When the readers are connecting with this person that they're not going to know as much about, even if it's a fictional character, because it's something you created. But can they see that person sort of come to life as they're reading? And that's really something really awesome and really great about being a writer, is sort of making that just more than words on a page, but making this person kind of embody something in the mind of the reader.
Have you ever written a scene where you're thinking, where you thought perhaps, what are they going to think of me when they read this?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I can certainly, it makes me blush when I'm thinking about it, but in the Ronan McCullough series, there's a couple of sexual scenes.
Okay.
So spoiler alert, there are a couple sexual scenes between Ronan and Ty in the story, because, they are in a romance together, and I'm terrible at writing sex love scenes. I mean, I can do it, but then I think, ooh, if my mother's reading.
That's exactly the way I think as well.
That. Or if my grandmother was still alive, what would she think? My gosh, what is my boss going to think? Or what is my next door neighbor down the street whom I love dearly, but she's 85 or 6? Astute religious woman. And here I am describing all these things. Oh, yeah, all the time.
I think they've heard of sex.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I'll bet.
But I just feel like those scenes, I'm like, ooh, I wonder if somebody reads this, if they're going to think, how did he know all this? Where did he get this?
He did his research.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the kind of research that sometimes can be interesting.
Well, when I wrote my first novel, I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. And we know that's the Bible Belt. You live in that area as well. And I remember I went to my first editor, and after reading the first chapter, she decided she didn't want to work on the book because of a sex scene. So there are people out there who are going to look at that and make judgment calls.
Sure.
I
think that's true, too. I have some of my characters that use really foul language, a lot of curse words and a lot of very crass language in their conversations with one another. And some of that comes from talking to law enforcement and talking to police officers and just hanging around them and listening to them talk to each other. That's how a lot of them talk to each other.
Right.
That's not necessarily how I talk. But you've got to put that kind of stuff in there to make it seem real and make it seem realistic. And I think about that sometimes too. I think, oh, I wonder what, when I've got four or five, really bad curse words here strung together in this dialogue, what's my mom going to think that I talk like this all the time, not around, stuff like that. So yeah, those kinds of things too, kind of make me pause and think, I wonder what somebody's going to think, about that. But again, it's just a part of the story, and to make it seem realistic and make it seem like these characters are functioning in the environment that they should be functioning in. Under the circumstances that you've created, you have to have some of those realistic details, even if it does kind of make you blush when you're writing it. Really make you blush when you know somebody's going to read it later.
I think that's actually when you become a writer, is when you allow yourself to get past those emotions. I remember there was a character in my first novel where he was a really bad guy, and I had to have him murder a character. But in a way, it was like a cat-and-mouse game, in that he was making her think he was going to rape her. And all along the way, she kept thinking these things. And he finally got her into the bathroom, made her disrobe, had her in the shower. And she's thinking, all she wanted to do was get out of that situation. But he had no intentions of ever leaving there without her being dead first. He did not rape her, but it was just that whole scene. And I remember crying for 2 days about that. I'm personally thinking, what are people going to think about me? But then I started thinking about it. If I'm going to be a writer, I have to accept this. This is that character. This is how vicious he is. And I have to portray this because that's who he is. So you have to convince yourself, forget about who's reading this and write what the character would do. Because they do come to life in that way. And then I've had people say to me, are you sick or what? Are you perverted? You know, because I wrote that scene. But, you know, that's that character and that's what he would have done. I don't think the book would have been the same without his true essence. So,
yeah, and I think that's the ultimate question when you get into those situations as a writer that you have to ask yourself is the book going to be different or not as good, quote unquote, but is the book going to have the same essence if I take some of those scenes, that dialogue, those circumstances out? And if you feel like it is, or it would change kind of the overall trajectory that you're going with the story, then you do need to keep it in there. And it can be tough calls. I mean, when I'm writing, you know, there's some really violent scenes in my book, all of my books, just, you know, what people do to other people, you know, what circumstances befall Ronan and what he has to do to other people to survive, you know, very violent. I've had moments where I'm writing those scenes, and at the end when I'm done, because it just makes me feel kind of uncomfortable, or I feel kind of slimy, you know, yeah, in some way, because I've been kind of rolling down in the muck with these terrible people that are doing awful things to someone else. And, but then I feel like, you know, in a way that's the essence of the story, and that's part of what has to happen in order for the narrative to continue forward. And so, sometimes being uncomfortable like that and sort of having the hair stand up on the back of your neck or have your face get flushed if you're writing a romance scene.
Right, exactly.
You know, you need that. You need that because, again, the reader's going to notice that and they're going to want to see that and pick up on that too as they're reading your book.
Right. If you don't feel anything, why will they?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and obviously this doesn't apply to every genre. If you're writing a children's book, you don't have to worry about any of that. But if you're writing some other type novel, you have to just let your imagination go and let those characters live in your mind, I think. I don't know what you've experienced. I'm sure you have with a lot of your authors. I had a guest on the other day. Her name is Cher Chisney. She's an Australian author. And this has a little bit to do with promoting. And what I loved about her, she's one of those that's not afraid to pick up a phone and call someone or send an email to somebody. And it's an interesting thing because there's a gentleman named Adam J.A. Cass, and he's a playwright. And he's fairly well known in Australia, and they produced his plays all over the world. And he happened to be working for this company that gets the inquiries or the query letters for people who are looking for the books to be made into plays. And Cher sent this there, and he said he was supposed to be passing this on to someone else. And when he saw her letter, he goes, I want to write this play. And so he did go ahead and send it on, but he made sure and wrote down all her information. And from that contact, her book is now being made into a play. Had she not stopped and said, if she had stopped and said, I don't think I can do this, I'm wasting my time, who would take this seriously, she would never have accomplished that. And I think that's something that most authors do themselves. Just like we were talking themselves out of writing. Where do I begin? How do I start? It's the same thing. When you're out there writing, you know, or promoting your book, don't be afraid to make a phone call. Don't be afraid to call someone up and call you up, get on your podcast, you know, that type of thing.
Oh, absolutely. And I think I go into those kinds of situations, James and Tanya, I know you probably have done this too. The worst someone can tell me is no.
Right.
My grandfather used to have this funny saying, and I don't remember the context of it now, but he used to say, well, they can't eat you.
Right.
You know, and he's been gone a long time now, but I think about that. Well, you know, if you ask if you, can you come on your show or could you help me or do you have any buddy that could help me do X, Y, Z, or whatever it is. I mean, the worst they can tell you is no, or no, I don't, or no, I don't have time for you. They can't eat you. So, you know, it's just one of those things where you can't be afraid to ask, because if you never ask, then you know what the answer is going to be.
Right.
No, if you never ask. But, you know, I feel like the writing community as a whole is so supportive and encouraging.
Yes.
And helpful and willing to help out and provide guidance and support and connections and to do what they can to help their fellow writers. I think in all the years that I've met, talked, and worked with writers, guys, I've met maybe one writer who was not that way. But every writer I've ever come across is more than willing to talk and to share strategies and tips, if it's promotions and marketing, or if it's, you know, writing yourself out of a difficult scene, or it's some of those other issues we've been talking about, those uncomfortable scenes that are necessary. I've never met a writer, except one, who was negative and not.
Was that one on your show?
No.
No? Okay. I've actually had one on my show.
I hope I never speak to that writer ever again, because he was a real jerk. And he will remain nameless. But
probably best.
But the writing community as a whole is so supportive and encouraging and welcoming, and folks want to help, and folks want to do what they can to help you not only become a better writer, but build your platform and help you with promotions and marketing. And that's true of bookstores. That's true of book festivals. That's true of anybody involved in books. And I think it's true of anybody involved in the arts in general. You know, people that like books and are involved in books and spend a tremendous amount of time doing something with books do it because they love it, not because we're all making a ton of money at this, and we're not doing it all because it's easy, not all doing this because it's the best thing that we could be doing sometimes at the current time. But they want to see books do well and stories be told and those stories reach an audience. And so don't be afraid to ask. The worst they can tell you is no. But oftentimes, again, like we were talking earlier with agents and publishers, when you're pitching your work, that person might say no, but I'm amazed at how many times they'll say, you know, that's not for me, or I can't help you, but I know so-and-so over here. Let me give you her email address. You contact her or him, and you'd be perfect, or they'd be more than happy to help. So now not only have you met the person that told you no, and that person's now a contact, now you're making a relationship with this other person. So there's always positives that come out of being told no when you're looking for promotions and marketing or any help. You know, sometimes the timing might not be right. You may have just got the wrong person at the wrong time, but it always leads to something more positive if you don't take that no immediately at face value and let it get you down too much.
Yeah, and I think that we're all guilty of it. It's so easy to say when someone rejects you of giving up, and you know, it always crosses your mind, like, am I doing the right thing? Am I wasting my time? But you can't. You just have to keep going. Tanya, you're very good at that, by the way. And I have to say, she encourages me so much. Even though I do radio, I'm in charge here. But when I have to go out and do signings, or first reading I ever did was for a group that Tanya sponsors, I was a nervous wreck. I mean, but you have to get past that. You just have to convince yourself, if you're going to do this, this is part of what it takes to be out there and be an author. You know, you have to present yourself.
So. That's right. You can't be afraid to talk about your book. And as writers, we're kind of introverts. Anyway, because we spend so much time sort of holed up in a room with a computer or a notepad writing. But you got to be willing to talk about your book. I always carry copies of my books with me in the trunk of my car, and I stole that idea from John Grisham.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You ever heard how John Grisham got started?
That's right.
When his first book, A Time to Kill, I think, came out. How he got his name out is he carried a box of books in his old, I don't know what car he
station
carried, the station wagon.
Yeah.
And he's from Mississippi, where I'm living now. Yeah. And he just, anywhere he could that would display his book or would listen to him talk about his book, he did. And that's how he got started. Now, you don't have to go to those extremes, but I always carry some books with me in my car, because you never know when you're going to come across, you know, traveling or going somewhere. You might find a gift shop. You might find some place that would be interested in stocking your book. And so that's a great way to kind of promote yourself. But I think, too, as authors, you should have an elevator pitch ready. If someone comes up to Tanya comes up to you, James, or comes up to me and says, oh, A Knife's Edge, what's that book about? You know, can you have an elevator pitch? Do you have a 30-second summation of what your book is about?
Yeah.
That's a great way to promote yourself. And because when you do book signings and book events, and a random person walks up to your table, that's the first thing they're going to say, oh, well, this seems interesting. What's your book about? And you can carry that over into being able to talk about your book. Once you have that elevator pitch, you get it kind of memorized and get it sort of a part of your psyche, you get more comfortable in talking about your book. I've found that it becomes more natural to you because you've got this set 30-second line that you can at least get started with, and then sometimes that might lead to more conversation. Yeah, can't be afraid to talk about your book. If you're writing, call yourself an author. You don't have to be on the New York Times bestseller list to be a writer. If you're writing something, even if you've never been published, if you're writing and putting the time and the work in, you're a writer. So don't be afraid to call yourself a writer. Don't be afraid to call yourself an author.
Right.
Because you are.
And also,
that's something to be proud of.
You know, and if you can't find a publisher, if you really believe in what you're doing, go out there and self-publish, because a lot of authors like Grisham were discovered as a self-published author. Some of their first books, Stephen King published a self-published book. So, you know, oftentimes that's how you get discovered. So if you can't find a publisher, don't be afraid, you know, just tackle it. You got to get discovered somehow.
Yes, and I'm a firm believer, and we talked about self-publishing earlier. I'm a firm believer that if you've got a good story, a good short story, a good novel, it's going to find a home.
Yeah.
It may not be your first choice. The home may not be your first choice. It might not be your second choice. It might not be your third choice. It might be a choice you'd never consider before. But if you've got a good story and a good book, it's going to find a home. And it's going to find someone who believes in that story as much as you do as the author who wrote it. And that's really all you can ask for as an author. And I've been so fortunate, the publishers I've worked with have been so supportive and been behind me 100% behind the story. But if you've got a great story, it's going to find a home. And it just may not be in the place that you'd expected. And that's okay too. But it'll find a home, and it will find somebody that's as excited about the narrative as you are. And that, when you get that as a writer, that's
right.
When you get that kind of synergy, that's when you know you're in good shape and you're on the right track.
Well, Elliot, we're running out of time. We're down to the last few minutes of the show. So where can we find out more about your work?
You can find out more about my book at my website. It's ElliotParker.com, ElliotParker.com. I've got links there to all the books, and I've also got interviews and reviews and
for your podcast?
Yes, and the link to the Now Appalachia podcast is also there as well. You can also find Now Appalachia on SoundCloud if you're a SoundCloud podcast listener. It has a Facebook page. It's just Now Appalachia, so if you're on Facebook, you can like the page, and every time a new episode's posted, it'll connect to your Facebook page. Now Appalachia can be heard on Podbean, on SoundCloud, on iTunes, on Spotify, anywhere you like to get podcasts. But my website's a great place to find that out and find out more information about me and my books. And again, you can find my books anywhere you like to buy books, anywhere you like to get them. But please, if you can, support your locally independent bookstores if you're fortunate enough to have one in your community, because they are oftentimes our biggest advocates and our biggest champions. Not only when we start writing, but as we keep writing as writers and keep getting published, they're the ones that are going to be your biggest cheerleader when
Absolutely.
You're not around advocating for your book. So if you can support those local bookstores, it's really, really a big help to your community.
And Tanya, where can we learn more about you, who you are?
I also have a website. It's Ms. Tanya Todd, mstonyatodd.com. And I'm at Ms. Tanya Todd on social media.
Okay. And to find out more about the show, just go to aspectsofwriting.com. This is your host, James Kelly, reminding you, if you can dream it, you can write it. Thank you, Ellie, and thank you, Tanya, for being on the show today.
Thank you all very much.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Aspects of Writing. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss every aspect of the writing industry. Until then, if you can dream it, you can write it.